So guys, welcome along to the Diabetes Chat this evening. We are joined by the amazing Jazz Zeffi. I'm going to hand over to Morgan. She's going to introduce us this evening's guest speaker.
We have got a good one tonight. I'm so excited. Jazz is an amazing advocate. She was diagnosed when she was 13. She is a dancer and a choreographer, and she has training from Broadway Dance Center in New York and the AEF from Florence. She's also the founder and director of the Diabesties organization, which I cannot wait to hear more about. Just reading up on the website was so baffling. I'm so excited. And she's very active in the community and really, like I said, excited to have her on. But yes, welcome, Jazz. Thank you so much for coming on tonight.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to speak to you all and hear from you all, and very, very happy to be here.
Yeah, well, once again, thanks for coming on. What time is it for you?
Well, right now, actually, I'm in LA, so it's 12:30 in the afternoon. But if I was back in India, it would have been 1 a.m. in the morning, which is also fine. Anything for diabetes.
What a time difference. You're over there by Chris. Chris is in California.
Oh,
yeah, Chris, I'm in San Diego.
Okay.
We do this little quick fire round of questions. Tom likes to do this 90-second questions thing, a bunch of diabetes related questions. If you don't mind, I can toss it over to him and he can do that.
Of course. I am very excited.
Hey, Jazz.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for coming on tonight. It's amazing to have you, and thank you for your time.
Of course. My pleasure completely.
You're welcome. So we'll kick off with our 90 second questions. What I'm going to do is just some quick fire questions. So yeah, are you ready to play?
Let's do this. I'm nervous and excited.
What's your name?
Jazz.
Occupation?
Diabetes advocate.
When you were diagnosed with diabetes?
When I was 13 years old.
What is your favorite hypo treatment?
Orange juice.
Have you had any type 1 complications? Yes or no?
No, not yet.
Do you use insulin pens or pump?
I use an insulin pump.
Do you finger prick or use technology, CGM flash?
CGM.
What pump do you use?
I use the Omnipod.
What CGM do you use?
The Dexcom G6.
What's worse, feeling hypo or feeling hyper?
Hypo, definitely.
Are you hypo aware?
At the moment, yes.
What three symptoms, if you have three, do you have of hypos?
Sweating, palpitations, numbing of the lips.
When you finger pricked back in the day, did you change your lancet every day?
Never changed my lancet.
I think we're all the same, to be honest.
Exactly.
One thing you like about your diabetes?
It gave me my purpose.
Oh, I love that. That's great. One thing you don't like about your diabetes?
You have to think about it all the time.
Do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
I really like it.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it? Some people like it, some people don't.
I really like it. I would wear it as a perfume as well.
Oh, that's ace. If you're on a desert island, what three things would you take? And it can include diabetes things. It's entirely up to you.
So I would take my phone. I would take my Riley Link, and I would take a lot of insulin.
There we go. Thank you, Jazz. That's our 90-second questions.
Yay, that was so fun.
It was great, wasn't it? Great fun. Honestly, thank you so much for coming on. I'll put that in a short video, and we'll get that up in the next week or so. What we're going to do this evening is we've got three amazing sections that Morgan's prepped for us, which is amazing. Chris is going to talk a little bit about your sort of background to diabetes care and where it all began. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about how you manage your diabetes with your sort of career and as a dancer, and talk a little bit about diabetes burnout, a few other things as well. And then Morgan is going to talk about the amazing foundation, Diabesties, and some what you do in projects and other things. But yeah, and then if anyone wants to get involved, you can hashtag Diabetes Chat, or you can request a mic and you can come talk to Jazz. Does that sound good with you, Jazz?
Awesome. Sounds amazing.
Brilliant. I'll head over to Chris.
Hey, Jazz.
Hi.
waving from down south. You probably can't see me, but I'm only a couple hours south of you.
Yeah, I'm waving right back at you.
So just getting started, being diagnosed at 13, do you recall what symptoms you had, how you felt at the time?
I do, actually. And I was pretty severe because I was sort of prepping for a football game. And, you know, we had a girls' team in school. I was 13. And I was losing a lot of weight. So I lost like 7 kgs in a week almost. I was constantly drinking water. I was constantly in the bathroom peeing. And, you know, we just kept thinking that it was because we were doing so much soccer practice that's why it was happening. And then a week or two later, when the symptoms got worse, we just sort of called the family GP, and they said, just get a blood test, get a normal routine test, urine routine. And the test results sort of went back to my doctor, and he called up my father, and he was just like, rush her to the hospital immediately. And when I walked in, my blood sugar was 1,050. And that's how I was diagnosed. It was a lot of weight loss. All this, like the 4 T's that we keep talking about, I had all of them like max.
1,000?
Yeah, 1,050.
Wow.
I'm impressed.
What's the conversion on that?
So 1,050 divided by 18, what would that be? I think around 58, 60?
Oh my, that is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I walked in. Like, the doctors didn't believe that I was that high. So when the results went back to my family GP, I was around 900, which is around, I don't know, maybe 58 or 56. And when I walked into the hospital and my father told the ER doctors that, you know, her sugar is this high, they just refused to believe me. They were like, no, she cannot be walking in with that high of a blood sugar. So they thought that the lab messed up my blood work. So they were like, you know, she's just dehydrated, but let's get a retest done at the ER. And when that result came, it was 1,050. It was what, 60 millimoles? And that's when they were like, oh, okay, this is happening. And they immediately like shifted me to the ICU and stuff. And that's where they declared that I had type 1 diabetes.
I bet the doctors were surprised that you were alive, let alone conscious.
I know. I mean, now that I think about it, I myself don't believe that I was walking in, you know, at that level. They were shocked that I was not in a coma. But I think it just all worked out somehow.
So have your parents been, I assume, very supportive as far as helping you with learning and managing as you, 13's kind of in the middle age. You're not a little kid, but you're not an adult yet.
Yeah, and that was really sort of frustrating at the beginning because, you know, you're just entering your teen years, your hormones are going everywhere. And as I'm sure all of you know, that the effect that hormones play on sugars, and my doctor sort of warned my parents in that till she's 19, because I was very hormonal as a teenager. So like my doctor literally warned my parents in that till 19, her blood sugar is going to be up and down and don't worry about it. But they were very supportive, like whether it was about trying new technology that was not available in India that we had to get from somewhere else, or from just actually they let me be really independent right from the beginning, which really sort of made me take care of myself. And whatever I wanted to try, if I wanted to like start the foundation and any part of the diabetes life, they were extremely supportive. And they would wake me up every morning at 4 to check when we were finger pricking. And my parents travel a lot. So they were, wherever they were in the world, you know, they would call up at 4 a.m. India time and wake me up to check. So I'm very grateful for like these little things that they did in the initial years that made me confident that type 1 was just a part of my life and not my entire life.
That's awesome. It sounds like you had better support than many people get.
I mean, I'm very, very grateful for that. Yes.
How did your friends take it? I assume you told your friends and schoolmates. Did it affect things there, making the adjustment when you were diagnosed?
So again, very grateful for the fact that my mother is the principal of a school. So I was in my mother's school growing up. So when I was in the ICU and once we knew what was happening, my mother did like a small presentation for my class. So she made like a little presentation and she explained what type 1 diabetes was to all my teachers and to my classmates. So I didn't have to do that at 13, but she did it for me. And my friends were so supportive. Like at that time, even I didn't know what was happening. You know, I didn't understand the permanence of it. I didn't understand how it was going to affect my life. But my, like, the basic thing that we knew right at the beginning was that, you know, we have to control what we eat. So my friends, and again, they're so funny, but they stopped eating the things that I couldn't eat right at the beginning. And that was just like a small way of showing solidarity. And luckily, we had a very small school, a very close group of friends. So they would sort of carry sugar, like glucose hypo treats for me. They would rush me to the hospital if I had to go. And they just sort of showed small ways of support, whether it was stop eating sweets for like a week. And then they started eating it again, which is fine. But just small ways of showing that, you know, they were, we were all in this together.
How was accessibility as far as things like insulin and testing supplies and all of that stuff? I know you've spoken about accessibility gaps in India and South Asia. But what was it like initially for you?
So, you know, like, luckily I can say that I come from a very, I speak from a place of privilege, and I'm very aware of that place of privilege when I speak and say that I personally did not have too much trouble with accessibility. My family and me, we were able to afford insulin. We were able to afford the test strips. We are able to afford the technology. But that is not true for 80% of the country, which is why a lot of the work we do at the foundation is to sort of try to bridge that gap. Because there's no insurance in India, so everything is out of pocket. And like I said, I was able to afford these growing up, but there are so many just like me who are not able to afford it. And that's just unfair. And that is what we are trying to work towards with the work that we are trying to do.
Are there any sort of memorable moments from when you were first diagnosed that really stand out to you? Like, do you remember your first hypoglycemic event? Do you remember injecting insulin for the first time and what that was like?
So there is actually a moment that I remember very clearly. It was just after I was discharged from the hospital. And a week later, we had that football, that soccer game that we were practicing for. And my coach was like, no, you can't play. And he was like, you've just gotten out of the hospital. It's not okay. You can't play. I just went to my doctor, and my doctor is the most incredible man. And I asked him, you know, can I play? Can I go out and play this match? And he was like, just carry hypo treats with you and you'll be fine. And the coach still didn't listen. So my captain, who was a very good friend of mine, I was on the bench. I was a substitute. And because at that moment, I was thinking that, oh my God, diabetes has gotten in the way of my life. And it was a week later, I was out there and my captain sort of ordered a substitution on the field without asking my coach and stuff. And I went in and I scored a goal. And in that moment, I was just like, you know what, I can do this. So it wasn't diabetes related, but the entire like chronology of events that happened just sort of made me believe that this condition was not going to come in the way of life. And that gave me a huge confidence boost right at the beginning.
Well, that's great. I mean, you say it's not diabetes related, but it kind of is.
Yeah, it is. Everything is diabetes related, Chris. Yeah.
Once you live with type 1, everything revolves around it.
That's true. That is life.
So what's your technology journey been like? I mean, I assume you started on older insulins, or did you go straight to the sort of modern, at least basal, with like Lantus or something similar and Humalog? And then how has your treatment evolved over time?
So initially, we did a lot of permutation combination with the types of insulins that we tried. I remember right after diagnosis, I was on Lantus and Novorapid. So I was on analogs right away, again, because my doctor was absolutely fantastic. And then, you know, over the years, just things just kept changing with my body. I had the weirdest insulin requirements at different times of the day. So then we went back to Mixtard for a bit. We shifted to Traceba. We did Levimer. We tried out everything. But towards the end of my MDI life, I was on Novorapid and Traceba, which worked well for me. But again, I had the most fluctuating sugars. And then when I got onto the pump, I went onto the Omnipod first. And I was on Novorapid in the pump as well. And then I stopped using the pump after a year because I think I was burnt out, or I just didn't want to have a device on my body. I used to be extremely scared of going through airport security. Again, this is when I was about 15 or 16. And then when I got more confident, I went back onto the pump. And ever since then, I have been on the pump and I'm currently on the DIY loop system as well. So that's been the progression of my diabetes treatment.
Well, that actually leads perfectly into the next question I have, which was, what is it like being the first person in India to use the DIY loop system?
It's quite incredible, actually. And I sort of learned about it from the diabetes online community. Of course, I'm sure all of you know Partha. So he introduced me to the world of looping at a conference that he met me at. And he saw my graph and he was like, we need to get you onto a loop system. So he connected me to a few people in the community. I learned a lot from them. And I was grateful enough and fortunate enough to have the technology that I could loop with. And I started looping and it was just mind-boggling. It was such a breakthrough. And I was the first person who began it in India. And my only aim and goal was to get more people onto it, you know? And then we started networking and doing a lot of awareness about it. And now I can say there are at least a community of about, I want to say 10 or 15 people who are looping in India. It's not enough. It's not at all there, but it's a small start. And that's how I think it's going to get better as well.
Well, I'm sure there are barriers there just with the access to the required devices and stuff to get people up and running with it.
Exactly. So that's what, you know, the idea is that looping, it's easy to do, right? You need to have a small device. You need to have a laptop, which most of people do. But if you don't have the right CGM or the right pump, then it's just not possible. So it's a much more systemic level change that needs to happen to get that affordability and that access into India first. And then looping becomes a cakewalk. But the problem is that it goes a little bit more deep-rooted. So we're trying to see what kind of hacks we can do. People are using the Libre and then adding like a third-party transmitter to be able to start looping. We don't have the Omnipod in India, so everyone has to go with legacy Medtronic pumps. Again, those are also very expensive. So it's a deep-rooted problem that we're trying to solve one step at a time.
Well, for what it's worth, I'm using a legacy Medtronic pump here in the U.S. right now for my... my Android APS loop, so.
That's right. So, I mean, I'm going to take some tips from you so that I can help out some more people in India as well.
You had episodes of burnout, and if so, how did you handle them?
Yeah, I mean, I think with me, what happened was because I was diagnosed at this age of 13, and I think a lot of people very earlier on, at least it's what happens in India, I guess. It's like the entire community is telling you how strong you are, you know, and how brave you are. And I didn't think I actually got enough time to process that it was okay to be vulnerable. It was okay to hate it at times. So I think it's just so many people, and with good intention, you know, I don't blame anyone, but with such good intention, they were saying that, you know, you got this and you're brave and you're strong and you're taking like 6 injections a day. And it was very new for all of us as well, right? So they didn't have anyone else that they saw was doing this. So in an effort to try to be positive and confident, it sort of made me think that I have to be brave. I have to be strong. I have to, like, you know, have this in my control. And that got so frustrating after a point, because inside there were points when I was breaking and I hated it at times. And I was going through ups and downs. My body was not able to handle it. But I had to put up this facade of being really, really strong. And that, I think, bottled up to an extreme where I broke out one day and I was like, I don't want diabetes. And it got to a point of me sometimes there were like weeks when I used to get hypo after hypo in the night. And one day I just got up and I was like, you know, I'm not going to treat this. Let's see what happens. And I think it was just the fact that I was not processing my emotions. And we don't talk about this enough. We don't talk about mental health and diabetes enough. And I think it's so crucial, especially when you're in those early years, to understand and recognize that it's okay to take breaks. It's okay to not like it. It's okay to be vulnerable. But that was my biggest burnout, I think. And I mean, now I think I understand the condition more. Also, back then, there was no education about what's happening to your body, right? You just do what the doctors tell you. In India, we don't have diabetes educators. So after so much self-learning, after understanding what's happening inside my body, the mind and body started working better together. But that was my biggest burnout. And it happens to everyone. And I think now I realize and recognize that it's okay to not like it at times. And that doesn't make you a bad advocate. It doesn't make you a bad diabetic. It doesn't make you someone who's not standing up for the community. And I think now I get advocates burnout more often than I get diabetes burnout. And I think it's okay for all of us who advocate for the community to recognize that everything on your Twitter or everything on your Instagram doesn't need to be about diabetes. But the intention is what matters. And the fact that you're doing something that other people are not doing is what matters as well.
Most definitely. And I'm sure there's other folks, especially around here. I know there's a lot of endocrinologists and diabetes specialists that live with type 1. And I'm sure they feel sort of a similar pressure and are even less able to talk about it.
Absolutely. I mean, the pressure is real. And I think we need to recognize that we're humans at the end of the day. We're living with a condition that is very difficult to manage. And we need to be okay with not being okay.
Absolutely. It makes you human. It doesn't make you bad.
Absolutely. Exactly.
All right. Well, I think that's it for the section I had. I'm just going to say, hopefully, if you spend a lot of time in LA, at some point, we should get you to one of the periodic meetups we have in Southern California.
I would love to come. So you let me know when the next one is and I'll be there.
Will do. All right.
Thank you, Chris. That was amazing.
I will toss it back to Tom.
Cheers, Chris. Thank you, Jazz. So far, amazing chat. A few people on the hashtag. Tony says, quote, anything for diabetes. What a quote, Jazz.
Thank you.
Diabetic Dad says he's tuning in for the amazing chat. That's awesome, Paul. And For Whom the Bell Tolls says, I've just heard your blood sugar. And wow, that's very scary.
It was definitely very scary.
I can imagine. So yeah, thank you so much for that first section with Chris. So we're going to talk a little bit about sort of your career in terms of dancing and how you sort of manage your diabetes in everyday life. So obviously, alongside being a director of Diabesties, which Morgan will be talking about soon, which is absolutely amazing, what made you get into dancing? Was it from a young age? Was it part of school or after school club? Or what was your sort of encounter with dancing? And what was your dream when you got into it?
Thank you for that. And so I began dancing when I was 5. My mom put me into a dance class back home in India. And the moment I walked into that class, I absolutely fell in love. And I just loved the way that, you know, you could tell a story with your body or you could tell stories with movement. And over the years, that passion for dance just kept growing. And I used to do like shows every year. And from 5 onwards, I knew that this was something that I was not just like happy to do. It was not something I just liked. It was something I was extremely passionate about. And like my love for dance sort of transcended into my love for performance and storytelling. And whether that was doing theater performances or doing drama or doing sort of performance pedagogy, it was really a more holistic world of performance studies, so to say. And I really got into that. And I do remember that when I was diagnosed, I thought that, you know, I had to stop dancing again, because there's just not enough information out there, at least in India, about what you can do with this condition. But I was very grateful again to have a dance school and teachers who really understood my condition, who supported me through the highs and the lows. And then when I was about 15, I started actually instructing and becoming one of the trainers at the dance school. And that's when life just took on a different gear, because I used to have like 8-hour rehearsals a day and, you know, just constant morning classes and evening classes and getting ready for shows and performing professionally. And it took a toll sometimes, but I realized at the end of the day that things were different, but nothing changed. My 8-hour rehearsal was still an 8-hour rehearsal. But what was different now was that, you know, I had to check my sugar, take a snack, take a break, check again. So the dream was the same, to perform professionally, but with a few modifications here and there.
So when you obviously were diagnosed at 13, did you first feel, oh my, I may not be able to do this? Did it worry you to think I might not be able to do this? Or did it worry your parents at all?
It did. It definitely did. And there was a conversation we had about whether we should continue or not continue. And I think the thing was, we said, let's take it slow. So, you know, we started off slow and we made our way up. And like I said, my teachers were fabulous and they really supported me. They let me take the breaks whenever I needed. And I think having that kind of a community support in whatever profession you are in really, again, boosts your confidence and makes you think that you can do this. And I was lucky enough to have that.
That's just awesome. Very encouraging, isn't it? Did you ever find that your diabetes ever impacted? Like, did you ever find it hard that you have to go off to inject or you have to go off and finger prick? You were talking about doing 8-hour rehearsals. I bet that's very intense and it's obviously very busy and very active. Like, how did you sort of manage your diabetes care in terms of them sort of everyday things that we have to do with injecting and finger pricking and eating and treating hypos? How did you sort of manage that?
So at least, you know, when I was in my the years when I was the most active while performing or while training, I do remember it used to get very difficult because, again, and I sort of put this on myself to say that I did not have enough education about how exercise impacts your sugars, again, because we're just not told enough when we are kids. We're not educated enough. So it was a lot of sort of figuring it out for myself to say that when I remember normally if I had a long sustained dance class, my sugar would start to drop. And that would be so different before I was getting on to perform. Like before getting onto stage, my sugar would become like 300, you know, because I didn't know that the adrenaline actually impacts your sugars or long sustained low intensity drops your sugars. And these things I learned practically while doing it. And then later, when I actually became a diabetes educator, I understood the science behind it. So it was a lot of figuring it out while I'm doing it, which was not the best, I would say, because again, it led to unnecessary fluctuations that could have been avoided. But now that I know more is what we're trying to do with the foundation as well, is to educate more people so that their dreams and their careers and their hobbies are not impacted with a, you know, figure out as you go kind of a policy, but more of a place of awareness, more structured, and they can do whatever they want, just like I did. But I just had to figure it out as I was going along.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like you said, it's taking them baby steps, isn't it? Taking it day by day, just taking it slowly and just working with them amazing people. And I guess that now as someone who's within that industry, like doing your own dance classes, you're very supportive to other people who have diabetes. So that's absolutely amazing. So what sort of hypo treatments would you have when you were dancing, rehearsing or competing or whatnot?
Yeah, no, I used to always carry my hypo tabs with me. So we used to get these like glucose tablets back in India. It's called hypo tab. And it's like 4 grams of fast acting carbohydrates. I would take like 4 of them if I was going low. I would carry a banana with me just to sustain. And then just have snacks, you know, in the middle. But hypo treatment for the longest time was those hypo tabs until I found out that, hey, juice is also an option. So then I shifted to juice. And now I think I oscillate between juice and glucose powder and hypo tabs and honey. I've recently discovered how honey works for me, and it's organic and it's natural. So, you know, because after a point, I got so sick of the hypo tab taste. I'm never going to have a hypo tab in my life again. I've had so many of them. Absolutely. But I think it's about just figuring out what works best with you. And for my body type, like juice just works better. So I try to, you know, get some nice juices here and there.
Absolutely. And I guess with technology now that enables you to track where your glucose is at, it can then enable you to be more active in your decision making. So that if you are seeing a trending arrow of going down or slightly down, that you may just take a bit of juice or you may take something that you can just sustain a good level rather than plummeting down, right down into the red. How often did you check your levels when you're dancing and stuff? Is it just every so often, or did you get into a routine of checking?
So, I mean, initially when I was, again, this is before I began looping, this is before I had a CGM, I would not be very good about checking just because, you know, the atmosphere of class is so hectic, and I'm the kind of person that gets so involved in something that I forget to do what is supposed to be done. So I would just have days when I would not check at all. And then I would go home and check, and I would sometimes be absolutely fine. Sometimes I would be too high, too low. I did make it a point later on to start checking at least before and after class so that at least I know where I have been and where I am. And then when I got the CGM, it just really changed things because it would alert me, and I could see my graph, I could see the trends, what you're saying. It's like a story and not just like a snapshot in time, which really sort of helped me with my dancing. And I don't dance as much as I used to right now because I'm much more involved in the foundation. But now whenever I do work out or whenever I do have a choreography session or something, I know where I am and I know what I need to do to make it better.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. So looking back, would you be quite strict with what you would eat and maybe sort of low-carb diet before you rehearse or when you are competing for long periods of time or in shows, whatever? Would you decide to have a low-carb diet or were you just, nope, we'll just eat whatever? How would you manage your sort of food intake?
Yeah, so I'm from the club that actually did not actually focus on diet too much growing up. Again, like I'm not like blaming this on anyone, but I just want to establish the level of education in India. It doesn't exist, you know. So again, I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just trying to say that we were not educated. Like for the longest time, I did not know carb counting till I was 20. So before I started the foundation, I started Diabesties in 2018. So from 2009 to 2018, I did not know carb counting. I'd heard of it, but there was no one to teach me. And whatever I would Google and stuff, it was so text heavy that I was not able to understand it. So I did not know that there was something called carb counting and there was something called insulin to carb ratio or insulin sensitivity factor. Because we are just told as kids that you're taking 8 units for breakfast, 8 units for lunch, 8 units for dinner. And we were on a fixed dose diet regimen for the longest time.
That's absolutely spot on. I recall mine when I was diagnosed. It was like, yeah, you're having these set insulins for the times for your meals or your background. Yeah. And that was it. And I did that for like 10 years until I went on to a carb counting program. So it's amazing, isn't it, how we sort of survived that period of time by just kind of rolling with it, I guess.
I'm still trying to figure out how when I was younger, I would eat maybe like an apple and take 8 units for it, you know, just because that's what we're told. And so I never actually, I don't know, my parents were very lenient with me. So I never had a diet as such growing up. I've never done low carb. I still don't do low carb. Now, of course, I know the science behind things. So I know nutrition and I understand the plate method. And I try to add fiber and I carb count. I know how much insulin to take for what I'm eating. But during those days of dancing, I would eat anything also because I was burning so much throughout the day.
I can imagine,
needed constant fuel, you know? So it wasn't a very restricted diet at all. It was a fixed dose insulin regimen. And then as I grew older also, you know, initially when you're diagnosed, you're like, you have to do what the doctor says. Like, even if I know that I'm going to go low, but no, the doctor has said 8 units, so I have to take 8 units. But as I got older and started taking it more into my control and understanding, you know, I would realize if I'm eating less, I need less insulin. Like, it became common sense after a point, and it is common sense, you know. If you're not eating too much or if you're eating less carb, you do not require so much insulin. And that just happened very organically. And now, of course, there's like a revelation of understanding. So that's what we're again doing with all our kids. We teach them carb counting and we teach them nutrition and stuff like that. But during those days, it was all trial and error.
100%. Yeah, totally agree. And that's where we hope that diabetes care around the world is more educating, isn't it? So that when someone is diagnosed with diabetes, whatever age, that they can get the full support and package as soon as possible so that it can help them with their full diabetes care.
Oh, absolutely. Education, I think, is so important. And I'm such an advocate for education now because I truly believe, right, that the pillars are all there. And the pillars are what we get even in India. So if you think of diabetes as a table, and I use this example all the time, you have 4 legs of the table. So you have diet, you have insulin, you have monitoring, you have exercise. But the tabletop that connects them all is education. And sometimes I just feel like, in India, it's just 4 legs of a table and there's no tabletop that connects it. So I think the tabletop in our case is the foundation or it's the work that we're doing, or it's just about making more people educative about their condition so that it breaks stigma, it breaks, miscalculations, it breaks wrongful sugars and fluctuations. So that tabletop is what is education, in my opinion.
I've literally just drawn that visual down, just nodding in agreement, saying yes. I can see that. Education is so important, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So talking, whether in general or when you obviously you were growing up dancing, how did you get on with your hypos, or how do you get on with your hypos now? Like, how are people supportive in you when you do have a hypo? Do they help you get your stuff? Are they supportive in knowing what they need to do. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about your experience of maybe having hypos during dancing or just in general now?
So I think in all my dancing days, like I educated my colleagues and my teachers about what to do in a hypo. And they were very prompt that way. So if I was going down and I could feel it a lot more back then, but I would be like, you know, I'm getting a hypo and there would be somebody grabbing my hypo tabs for me. There would be somebody grabbing my meter for me. There would be someone taking over the class if I was the one instructing it. So that way it was very, very supportive. I do remember one instance of when I was actually performing on stage. And this is like all out. I'm in the first row. I'm performing on stage. And I'm getting a low on stage while I'm dancing. And I sort of, there was a movement where I went and I told one of my partners that, you know, like, I'm going low. And he literally spun me out of stage. During the performance, we improvised. He spun me out of stage to backstage. And in the green room, I was correcting my hypo. So I think it was just about really understanding. Because, you know, I think also wise, because they used to see me when I was low. And, you know, when you're diagnosed earlier on and when you have diabetes for a couple of years only, your low symptoms are really extreme. You know, like I used to be sweating and I used to be like drenched with sweat and trembling, yes, and shaking. And they've seen that and they know that this is no joke, you know. So I think they never humored my hypo, which is something so important for everyone. That when a person with type 1 is telling you that they are low, don't take it as a joke. Don't take it like, oh, it's going to get better. Don't take it like it's going to be fine without any intervention. Because I think the dangers of a hypo, once you see it and once you recognize it, then humoring someone saying, oh, it's going to get better, it's going to get better, it doesn't work. And I think all of my colleagues and teachers back when I was dancing never, ever took it for granted. And they never, ever took it as it's just a joke or it's not serious enough. And that's the reason why I never got too low in those dancing years and I was able to correct it.
Absolutely. And I think that's like looking at that, it's like you said, already it's about education yourself but also educating other people so that they can support you and use the right methods. Touching upon it, I guess, is what's your sort of views on sort of stigmas and have you had any sort of moments over the years where you've fought with it? Like, is there any significant moments that stand out for you?
So in India, diabetes stigma is like a boiling pot, you know. You have people, very educated people, who would come to my father even today and be like, you know, try these remedies, try these cures, get rid of insulin. There is a fear of insulin. There is a stigma around insulin in our country and I think all over the world because it's an injectable. And also because I think doctors sort of use it as a last resort for type 2 diabetics. And because we see a lot more prevalence of type 2, you know, you'll often hear people saying that, oh, you know what? If you don't control your sugars, I'm going to put you on insulin for a type 2. And insulin becomes the bad guy. Insulin becomes the enemy. And then when you have someone who's injecting insulin every day, people's cross-references happen that time. Oh my gosh, he's taking the worst thing that can happen to someone is insulin. So that stigma is very prevalent. So I have also been told multiple times that, you know, stop your insulin, try something else. You don't need insulin. So insulin is why we're trying to do an entire campaign saying I love insulin, just to be like, yo, this is my lifeline, this is what's going to keep me alive, so don't mess with that. But other than that, just I would say that there's so much stigma in just terms of marriage in India, girl child in India, about and having type 1 diabetes. It becomes a burden. She becomes someone who is flawed. She becomes someone who cannot be married. And not me personally, but I've heard the most disturbing stories of these kind of instances that happen. And again, it's all about education. People think type 1 is contagious. Little kids in villages are disowned from their parents. They're sent to their mother's house. And it's not a pretty scene at all. And I think the more we educate and the more we normalize it is what is important. And I believe someone was talking about representation earlier on, and I cannot agree more. We need to have more normalized representation of type 1 diabetes. It doesn't have to only be in a zombie apocalypse that you have someone injecting insulin. Why can't there just be a character who has type 1 normally in the film? And I keep saying that you have the big stars doing it in movies and it makes it much more normal. Suddenly, if you have a Shah Rukh Khan or a Tom Cruise injecting insulin in a normal film, people will accept it more. That's just unfortunately how it is. So we need more representation to normalize it. And that is also what will break stigma.
And have you ever grown up, or even now, that you find it hard, maybe, or maybe going back actually when you were on instant pens, did you ever, when you're out for a meal or something, like, how did you fare with injecting yourself in the public or checking your blood? Did you ever, were you a bit anxious of that, or have you always been quite confident in doing that in the public? And can you see why people may not want to do it in public? Because, like, I'm on in injection pens, and even now, 16 years on, I still find it very difficult to be, say, in a restaurant at a table with my wife and my son, and I need to get my injection pen out. Like, I have got better, but I just worry of what people say. And to be honest, I've had not many encounters over the years, but you know what I mean? It's just part of me just feels there's eyes watching or people maybe saying stuff. But yeah, have you had any sort of episodes like that?
So I totally agree with you. And that's why, you know, whenever we're talking to our kids in the foundation also, we never like force that you have to inject in public. It's a personal choice. Yes. It's a personal transition. And that's totally fine. I do remember sort of being a little apprehensive and shy earlier on. And then it got better over the years. But what I did struggle with a lot, and that's really funny, it was actually the insulin pump, having a pump on my body. I was not that bad with injection, but with the pump, I don't know why. And it's under my clothes. People can't even see it. But like I said, this incident with airport security, I used to get so scared to go through airport security that I used to, after a point, remove my pump before going in and then wear a new one outside. It was so bizarre. But because, you know, I remember once, again, this is just also because airport security doesn't know about an Omnipod, or doesn't know what it looks like. And for the longest time, like, we used to be packed down, we used to be frisked in India, and they would sort of feel the pump and they would just make such a huge deal out of it. And they'll be like, what is this? What is on your body? Remove it, this, that. And I used to get so anxious about it. And then my dad just told me very normally one day that people with pacemakers, they go through security. I was like, yeah. Like, they needed to survive. I was like, yeah. So this is your pacemaker. This is your life support system. So if someone says, you know, remove your pump, you are tell them, are you going to take responsibility for my life when I don't have insulin on me? And I think he made it so matter of fact for me that I was like, yeah, this is what I need to survive. This is my oxygen. This is my water, you know? Yeah, and that just sort of shifted the way I thought about it. And it was not about a confrontation. It was about a conversation. And I sort of understood that, yeah, this security lady doesn't know, has never seen an insulin pump in her life before. Let's educate her about it. Let's have a conversation with her about it. And my dad just literally told me, what's the worst thing that can happen? You'll have to remove it, right? You have an extra one in your bag. So I think just making it so normal is what shifted my opinion on it. But again, it's a personal choice. It's a personal journey. I will never force anyone to do something that they're not comfortable with. But if we just normalize it a little bit more to be like, this is your oxygen, this is what you need to stay alive, I think it can start a good conversation about it.
Absolutely. That's amazing, Jazz. I'm just literally listening with so much like admiration. That's just amazing. I love it. Thank you so much. Morgan, we're going to head over to you now and we're going to talk about the foundation.
Yay!
Enjoy.
Thank you.
First, thank you so much for everything. Like, I was so excited, and it's living up to all my expectations of everything that you're saying. And I'm loving it.
Thank you.
So now we're getting to the part where we're talking about your foundation, your organization. You are the founder and director of Diabetes. Could you just kind of tell me how you came up with this idea and like what your thought process was? And I guess kind of the birth of the foundation, like how did it all start?
Right. So that's a very interesting story, actually. Thank you for that question. So, you know, like I said, growing up, and I've given enough context about the fact that, you know, we're not educated enough in India, but I've always been a very curious person. So I used to go onto YouTube a lot as a kid and just write type 1 diabetes. And more often than not, I would find just like doctors' videos, you know, like 2-hour lectures of someone sitting on a gray background and just talking for 2 hours. Now, for a 13-year-old, that was really not engaging. So my actual vision for Diabesties earlier on when it began was I just wanted to create a YouTube channel. I wanted to make a YouTube channel that was fun, that was not so bleak and depressing, and that had color, that normalized type 1 diabetes,
that made it fun with like pop culture references, because I kept thinking of me as a 13-year-old. You know, as a 13-year-old, what would I understand? I would understand if a Disney princess had type 1, how would that be? Or if Harry Potter had type 1, how would that be? And I wanted to create something like that. So that is how it actually started. It started as me creating a YouTube channel, making it super fun, lighthearted, at the same time trying to educate. And then we had like our first meetup. I said, okay, you know what? We're doing this. Let's just meet other people with type 1. And I literally had to go to my doctor and ask for his patients list. And he gave it to me. And though I made personal phone calls to about 30, 40 people. And the first thing I would tell them is, you know what? Hi, my name is Jazz. I also have type 1 diabetes. That was my icebreaker. And I said, okay, we're having a small meetup. Nothing was planned. It was very organic. And I literally thought that there are going to be 5 people that turn up. I was like, you know what, guys? I had a couple of friends with me. I was like, if even 5 people show up, that's fine. But in that first meetup with zero context, with nothing, we had 25 people show up. And that's when I knew that there was a need. People wanted to feel peer support. People wanted to feel like they are part of something larger than themselves. People need to know that they are not alone. And that sort of empathy-driven advocacy is what the Diabesties Foundation is all about today. That's how it started. And 5 years later, we are a registered foundation. We work with all the national bodies of diabetes in India and across the world. And we're doing a lot of work on access and advocacy and education and support.
That's absolutely incredible. Were you like shocked as just more and more people just started showing up? You're like, wait a minute, what is going on?
Oh, absolutely. I was like, this is not what I had planned. This is not what I'd imagined. But I think the fact that more and more people kept turning up every single time just showed me that there was such a lack and such a gap, you know? Because oftentimes in India, when you're part of a support group, it's taken as a negative that, oh, you're weak, that's why you need support. It's not taken in a positive light, seeing that peer support is actually for a collaborative conversation, for learning from each other. No, it's taken like, why do you need support? It's taken in a negative. So that's why all the work we do, and if any of you have seen any of the work that we do, it is, even the design aesthetic is not about making it feel like it's depressing and it's bleak and it's a disease. It's about making it more that this is our life, and this is our life that we're very, very empowered by. So all the collateral, all the stuff we do, it's about having fun with education. It's about creating diabetic games. It's about learning from each other. It's about lifting each other up. And we're very conscious about the way we present, because I honestly feel that advocacy does not have to be boring. And I've always maintained that. And I use a lot of my performance years training into this. It's about storytelling. We all are stories before we are statistics, you know. We are names before we are numbers. And that's the message that we want to give out to people through the foundation.
Yeah, and I know y'all do like so much, just like going through the website, y'all have so many resources and like a whole list of projects that y'all are doing. But to get to that point, what would you say was like the biggest challenge of trying to get as big as you are, as involved in the world as the foundation is?
So I really think as bad as COVID was, it was actually really good for us in a certain way, because before COVID, we thought that we had to have a physical presence to be able to deliver impact. And through COVID, and just through this entire new normalcy of virtual, we've realized that that's not the case. So we really expanded very, very wide through the pandemic, because everything was virtual. Suddenly being there physically was not important anymore. So we were able to reach out to corners of India that we had never imagined. Like, there was no way I thought that I would be in like a corner town of a small town village somewhere, because we don't have physical presence there. But through the pandemic, and that's what we've also used to make it into normal SOP and normal protocols and normal practices, is to expand and deliver impact virtually. And then that virtually, you know, gives you someone who is a physical presence there, and then it grows. But during the pandemic, we really reached out. We did Connect One, which was a conference that we did all over the world. And I think initially just networking with the right people at the right time has helped us grow. And I always tell my team that it's not about delivering outcomes. It's about delivering impact. So currently the Diabesties Foundation has 50 people who are working in it, and they're all people living with type 1 diabetes. So it's just organically grown, and I'm very, very thankful and grateful and blessed
that
to have
amazing, it. That is amazing, Jazz.
Yeah, that's incredible.
If any of you want to join, hit me up.
That was actually one of my questions. Have you thought about like expanding it to other countries and having different chapters like around the world?
Yeah, so we currently have 20 chapters in India, and we just last month, no, earlier this month, we had our first Saudi Arabian Daya meet. So we have a chapter in Jeddah, which is in Saudi Arabia, and that's our first expansion into the Middle East. We are hoping to start a chapter in Dubai and Abu Dhabi as well. And even in Jeddah, we had the same Daya meet. So the beauty of, I think the one thing that we've done right over these years is sort of document everything very well. So now we have like Daya Meet starter kits. So if you want to have a Daya Meet in your city, we have the documentation planned. So the entire idea behind this was to make it sustainable and scalable. So how does that happen? It's when you have the easy handbook kind of a vibe, you know, to say that, okay, this is what you need to do first. This is what you need to call. This is who you need to plan with. And it's all documented. So that way for all our projects, we have this documentation. So that's how the expansion to the Saudi Arabia was very, very easy and organic because we had it all planned out and documented. So yes, the chapters are running good. We always are absolutely happy to expand anywhere in the world because diabetes is universal and peer support is universal. So why can't we make this also universal?
That is absolutely incredible. I feel like it's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger.
Thank you. Hopefully.
Oh, so I did want to kind of talk about a few of like the certain programs that y'all have, like one Back to Basics. Do you mind talking a little bit about that one? I was really fascinated with this.
So Back to Basics is one of the most impactful projects from Diabesties, and it's one of my favorite projects as well. And at least we used our collective experience as people living with type 1 diabetes in India to actually give birth to this project. So in India, at least, you know, we get like around 30 to 40 seconds with a doctor for a consultation. It's not a collaborative discussion. It's more of a one. It's like, you know, it's very prescriptive. And you spend like 40 seconds with your doctor. And that's just not enough to know more, right? So Back to Basics is a one-on-one education and counseling program driven entirely by people living with the condition. And that lived experience bit is what actually makes it so unique and special. So anyone from anywhere in the world can schedule a B2B session with us. You just have to WhatsApp B2B to our helpline number. It's a bot automated response. You give your name, you give your age, you give a time slot that is convenient for you, and you give a language that is convenient for you. So we really want to make it as customizable as possible. So if someone is not, let's say, comfortable in English, but they are comfortable in Hindi, they can schedule a session in that language. And then you choose the topic that you want to know more about. And we have a wide list of topics. So it could be diabetes technology, it could be diabetes distress, it could be carb counting, it could be injection technique, any one topic you choose. And then you are cross-referenced to one of our B2B trainers. Now, these B2B trainers are all people living with type 1 who work at the foundation, and they're also a professional. So they're either a healthcare professional, or they're a diabetes educator, or they're a psychologist, or they're a dietitian. So you are cross-referenced to one of these trainers, and then you have a one-hour session with them. And we teach through our resources, we teach through explanation in their language, in their particular time slot. And the responses that we have gotten from this project. So over the last 2 years, we've scheduled over 750 calls from all over the world. And we have not only seen an improvement in a quality of life standpoint, but we have seen a clinical improvement as well post B2B sessions. The testimonials are very impactful, but the fact that there's been a reduction in HbA1c, or there's been an increase in time in range, or there's been a reduction in frequency of hypoglycemias, it just means that this project works. Because the feedback that we've gotten from most of our participants is that we're able to ask more questions judgment-free. We are able to, you know, ask and request them to reteach a topic. You can't do that with a doctor just because there's a time constraint. So this project is a full-on education project, and it's a collaborative effort with the doctors because none of us are endocrinologists. None of us are ever going to prescribe insulin. So we tell the doctors that, listen, you do the prescription. You are the scientist here. You know how to prescribe insulin. You don't have the time to educate. So let's work together. Let us do the education. You do the prescription. And that person's quality and quantity of life increases.
Wow. I'm just kind of speechless. That's amazing. So anybody in the world can like just request a session, even if they've had it for years and they want to know something.
Absolutely. And it's free of cost. You can schedule as many sessions as you like. We, in fact, reschedule follow-up sessions with our participants. And it goes on for hours. There's no time limit. These are all people with lived experience. We've got people who've been type 1 for 20 years who've been on mixed insulin for the longest time. And we've done the education with them. We've got people. So we have psychologists on our trainers as well. So we get many, many requests for burnout and distress, which our psychologist leads the sessions with. And the instant connect is that the person you are talking to understands exactly how you feel because they are living with the same condition.
And I think that's something even more special about it is that you're talking directly to someone who knows exactly what you're going through.
Exactly.
That's something that you don't often get in a regular doctor's visit or a regular hospital visit. Just them taking the time to just sit down and like, answer all the questions you have judgment-free. That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is one of my favorite projects just because of how impactful it has proven out to be. And again, we started during the lockdown because we thought that this was required during the lockdown. And now it's just become one of the most widespread projects by Diabesties. And I really think that, so we've got trainers from, like I said, Jeddah. We've got trainers that speak multiple languages. We've gotten sessions scheduled from the UK, from Canada, from US, from Africa, from Australia, just because I feel like there is a need to get education in a judgment-free way. And this project has just become like a pathway to that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but I know there's been times where I didn't ask my questions because I was afraid of judgment from like my doctor or whoever. So that's an amazing thing. Okay, so for those who aren't really aware of language matters and like what I guess its purpose is in the diabetes realm, do you mind explaining a little bit about it and what the whole goal is?
Yeah, sure. So language matters is sort of now become a movement, a global movement. For the language we use, and I'm saying we, and I don't only mean healthcare professionals, it's now sort of become a more collective consciousness about the language we use when talking about diabetes, when talking to someone who has diabetes, or by just generally having these messages in public. It's about also understanding that positive language actually leads to positive outcomes, and there's research being done in the UK about this. So the Language Matters guides are just these sort of very loose guidelines that are up on the Language Matters website, translated now into more than 12 languages, that give you suggestions and alternatives of just normal language that we use when addressing someone with diabetes or while talking about it. I'll give you a very simple example, and this is one of the examples I use the most. It's about typing the type. In any kind of general messaging, if you don't type the type of diabetes, that can lead to confusion. It can lead to someone who has just been diagnosed and is hopeful and desperate to search for an alternative. It can give them a misleading reference, and that could also lead to very, very fatal outcomes. An example of this is diabetes reversal workshop, and we see this time and again, but none of them ever mention type 2 diabetes reversal. It's always just diabetes. And the idea is that we need to realize that diabetes is not a generic term because the types are different, the physiologies are different, the treatments are different. And then other things like a person suffering from type 1. You've heard this constantly. And again, these kind of language, they add to stigma. They add to misinformation. And we're trying to avoid that at all costs. So we now have a Language Matters Diabetes website. It's called languagemattersdiabetes.com. It is a hub to all the documents and guides. You can go on them. They're free to download. And there are some other sections like an overview section. There's a testimonial section. So go have a look. It's a great way to educate yourself and share it with people that may not know the importance of language when talking about diabetes.
Yeah, it's something that's super important, especially within advocacy and in the doctor's office and all that. So I think that's a really great thing, you know, trying to make people think about, you know, the things that they're saying, typing, you know, all that other stuff.
Yeah.
So what can we kind of expect more from Diabesties from you? Do you have any future projects or speeches or guest appearances? Like what does the future look like?
So I think with Diabesties, we've got a couple of very interesting projects planned for the rest of the year. Simple things that like we launched a comic book 2 years ago, and this was inspired by the comics done in the UK. It's called Blue Light, so we'll have edition 2 coming out. We're working on a children's starter kit for diabetes for young kids, for them to not only like understand more about their condition with childlike references, I would say, but also just to be able to process their emotions from a young age. We have a project called Caregivers Council, which is addressing that caregivers need care too. So just yesterday, we actually had an event. I mean, you guys can follow the Twitter handle or Instagram just to keep up with our projects and events. We're pretty active, I would like to say. We do something every week at least. And I mean, as I know more, you will all know more as well. So, but just expect a lot of work on the advocacy front and the access front, and education will always be there. And support as well. So, I mean, in March, we did 18 dia meets all over India. On the 12th and the 19th of June, we're doing 36 different dia meets all over India. So if anyone wants to, you know, witness one of these, start one of these, just DM me personally and we can take it from there.
And one final question. First, I just want to tell everybody, like, if you, like, not even if you, just go look at the Diabesties website. It is absolutely incredible. all of the things that they're doing. I wish we could talk about every single one, but I do want to open it up to anybody who does have questions. But, like, my final question for you with this section is, do you have any advice for people who want to kind of do what you're doing in a way, or become an advocate for diabetes? Any like words of advice, like that you wish that you would have had, or, you know, just something that you've learned?
So I think, you know, oftentimes people think that being a diabetes advocate means doing a lot for a lot of people. I think that's the misconception. I honestly believe that change begins with one person, and that's how Diabesties started as well. So advocacy and being someone to stand up for the community does not have to be loud and large. It can just be with educating one person about it, or having a small presentation in your school, or just tweeting something about it, you know? And that's one more than somebody else is doing for the community. So start small and, you know, start with people around you. And that's how the circle of influence actually grows. And whatever you do, even as small as you may think it is raising the profile of type 1 diabetes. So don't be afraid because you may not have the reach or you may not have the numbers. Because what matters is the intention with which you're doing it and the fact that you are doing it. So just believe in that, and you are helping the community in some way or the other.
Thank you so much for that. And I really sincerely thank you for coming on. This has been absolutely incredible. I've just loved every single word. But yes, thank you so much.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for the invite.
We've got a few people that have jumped on the mic. T1D, Emmanuel, did you have any questions for Jazz?
Hi, Tom, and hi, everything, everyone. Thank you, Jazz, for everything you are doing. And thank you for expanding your what you are doing for the community to all the world. And I don't know what can I say about reaching Saudi Arabia. That's a great move. Thank you for everything.
No, thank you so much. And we should definitely connect to see how we can spread it even further in Saudi Arabia. And I would love to work with you on that.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. And I love that T1D community. They are doing great, great job. Everyone. And Jazz, one of the best in this community. Thank you, Jazz.
Thank you so much. That's very kind.
Hi, Jazz. First of all, that was a really, really nice talk with you. I have enjoyed so much all that you have shared with us today. I would like to also, maybe later I will follow up with you, that I would like to start this same or similar chapter back in Costa Rica, because back in Latin America, well, even what a CGM looks like is kind of a myth back
right,
there.
No, absolutely.
And then everything else is just starting over there. Like, for example, I know that there are just one option back in, like, maybe in the 7 countries and more. That is the freestyle livre. And is less than, and then the other option is just to get it from other countries. So it's really hard for other people to get those medical equipment.
Yeah.
But totally, I'm up to the part of educating people. And because it's really hard for me, for example, trying to explain people back in Costa Rica, like, hey, I'm type 1 diabetic. And it's like, oh, man, did you eat too much sugar for that? And it was like, no, but
sure. I totally agree. And I think there's so many similarities between what you're saying and in India. So do connect with me and we can see what we can do for sure.
Sure. And then if you need anyone who needs to translate something to Spanish, also, I will be happy to do that. So
lovely. Lovely. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thanks.
Awesome. Jazz, a couple of comments on the hashtag. Going back from earlier on in the discussion, really. Beatrice says, yes to Jazz, talking about type 1 diabetes and the mental health on diabetes chat. I've had it for 18 years and most days are still a struggle. Especially when I was younger, sometimes I just wanted to give up and not give my insulin. This needs to be spoken about more. 100%. Chris, who's on the panel, says, wow, listening to Jazz discussing the stigmas about insulin use in India. I can't believe that medical professionals are using medication as a threat. That's just so, so sad and scary, isn't it?
It is. It is, and it's unfortunately the reality.
And Tony follows up on that and says, this comment has rung true for me too. My parents have had this strange stigma with insulin, with his dad having type 2 diabetes and was threatened with insulin in the past. It's just horrendous, isn't it? It's just uncalled for.
I actually had a follow-up for Jazz regarding the use of insulin as a threat. I know you've spoken at conferences a lot. I didn't get to see it live, but the DietechCon about a month ago and some of your other presentations, I've actually watched the videos. But I didn't see necessarily that topic come up. As far as addressing sort of the provider attitudes, is that something that you think there's a potential way there to address that and try to correct it from both the telling patients it's okay, but also telling providers to stop this?
Yeah, I mean, I have addressed this in a couple of sessions when we've spoken about language. And I mean, it's a conversation that constantly comes up, you know, here and there. But I do agree. I think we need to do a better job of addressing it at the root. And hopefully in my future talks, it's going to come up a little stronger.
Awesome. Thank you.
Of course.
I just wanted to ask one final question from me, if that's all right. I know you said earlier on, right at the beginning, that your mum was such a massive support in your early days, and I'm sure over the years, and you mentioned about how she supported you in like educating the school and classes and in helping them understand your diabetes. I know you have the back to school kits. I just wanted to see if you wanted to talk a little bit about them, because I just think they're absolutely amazing. I'm a teacher myself, and I just think these sort of resources that are helpful for a variety of people, whether it's teachers, people in school, you know what I mean, and obviously the person with the diabetes itself. I just think they're amazing. And was the idea behind these kits kind of influenced with like your sort of how your mum sort of supported telling people about diabetes? Did it kind of come from there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, honestly, also because we interact with so many kids in India on a constant basis, we've got parents coming to us and being like, you know, help us tell the teachers, you know, like we don't know how to. The fact that my mom was my school teacher was very easy for her to explain. But that's not the case with like 95% of the kids going to school. So we wanted to make it so simple for parents to reach out to the school authority. So along with this kit, actually, there's also a template letter that we've created. You just put in your school principal's name, you put in your child's name, and it's a drafted letter to, you know, inform the school authorities about your child's condition. So we wanted to make it simple, easy to understand. So we've got three versions. We've got the kit for staff members, for teachers, and for parents. Little pocket handy guides. And we want to make, like I said, right, the idea is to make it as simple for them to communicate to the authorities, all you have to do is, you know, because also parents get anxious. They don't want to have to talk too much about it. Maybe they're still coping. So you just give the teacher the letter, you give the teacher their handbook, and you know, it becomes an aid for them to also understand about their child's condition. So it's up, it's online. You guys can download it for free if you want and use it as necessary.
I was about to plug that then and say it's absolutely free, so go check it out.
Yes.
Amazing. Mo on the hashtag has just said, Jazz has inspired me to educate people back in Indonesia about the importance of language and managing diabetes effectively despite the limited resource. So thank you so much. That's amazing, isn't it?
Thank you.
That's it, Jazz. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting to us guys and the community. It's just been such an honor and just totally blown away. Just thank you so much.
Thank you for the invite. It's been a pleasure talking to you all. And of course, we will stay connected on Twitter. And thank you so much. It's been great.
Thank you, Jazz.
Thank you, Jazz.
Thank you.